This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Strange Weather by Joe Hill. Performed by Will Wheaton, Dennis Boutsakaris, Kate Mulgrew, and Stephen Lang. With an afterword read by Joe Hill.
Snapshot. 1. Shelley Buick stood at the bottom of the driveway, squinting up at our pink sandstone ranch as if she had never seen it before. She wore a trench coat fit for Humphrey Bogart and carried a big cloth handbag printed with pineapples and tropical flowers. She could have been on her way to the supermarket if there were one in walking distance, which there wasn't. I had to look twice before I registered what was wrong with the picture. She had forgotten to put on her shoes, and her feet were filthy, almost black with grime. I was in the garage doing science, my father's term for what I was up to any time I decided to ruin a perfectly good vacuum cleaner or TV remote. I wrecked more than I'd built, although I had successfully wired an Atari joystick into a radio so I could jump from station to station by pressing the fire button, a fundamentally stupid trick that nevertheless impressed the judges of the 8th grade science fair, where it earned me the blue ribbon for creativity. On the morning Shelley turned up at the base of the driveway, I was working on my party gun. It looked like a death ray from a pulp-era science fiction novel, a big horn of dented brass with the butt and trigger of a Luger. I had, in fact, soldered together a trumpet and a toy gun to create the body. When you pulled the trigger, though, it sounded an air horn, popped flashbulbs, and blew a storm of confetti and paper ribbons. I had an idea that if I could get the gun right, my dad and I could bring it to toy manufacturers. Maybe license the idea to Spencer Gifts. Like most budding engineers, I hone my craft on a series of basically juvenile pranks. There isn't a single dude at Google who didn't at least fantasize about designing X-ray goggles to see through girls' skirts. I was aiming the barrel of the party gun into the street when I first spotted Shelley, right there in my sights. I put down my bozo blunderbuss and narrowed my eyes, looking her over. I could see her, but she couldn't see me. For her, looking into the garage would have been like staring into the impenetrable darkness of an open mine shaft. I was going to call to her, but then I saw her feet and the air snagged in my throat. I didn't make a sound, just watched her for a bit. Her lips moved. She was whispering to herself. She darted a look back the way she'd come, as if afraid someone might be sneaking up on her, but she was alone in the road. The world humid and still under the lid of an overcast sky. I remember that all the neighbors had put their garbage out, and the trucks were late, and the avenue stank. Almost from the first, I felt it was important not to do anything to alarm her. There was no obvious reason for caution, but a lot of our best thinking takes place well below the level of conscious cogitation and has nothing to do with rationality. The monkey brain absorbs a great deal of information from subtle cues that we aren't even aware we've received. So when I came down the slope of the driveway, I had my thumbs hooked in my pockets and wasn't even looking directly at her. I squinted into the horizon as if watching the flight of a far-off airplane. I approached her the way you'd close in on a limping stray dog, one that might lick your hand with hopeful affection, or might lunge, upper lip drawn back to show a mouthful of teeth. I didn't speak until I was almost within arm's reach of her. "Oh, hi, Mrs. Bukes," I said, pretending to notice her for the first time. "You okay?" Her head swung toward me, and her plump face instantly settled into a look of pleasant benignity. "Well, I've got myself all turned around. I walked all the way down here, but I don't know why. This isn't my day to clean." I hadn't seen that one coming. Once upon a time, Shelley had mopped and vacuumed and tidied the house 4 hours every Tuesday and Friday afternoon. She was already old by then, although she had the brisk, muscular vigor of an Olympic curler. On Friday, she left us with a plate of cake-soft, date-filled cookies, protected by a film of saran wrap. Man, those were some cookies. You can't get anything like them anywhere anymore, and no creme brulee at the Four Seasons ever tasted so good with a cup of tea. But by August 1988, I was just weeks away from beginning high school, and it had been almost half my life since Shelley had cleaned for us on a regular basis. She'd stopped working for us after her triple bypass in 1982, when the doctor told her she ought to take some time to rest herself. She'd been resting ever since. I'd never given it much thought, but if I had, I might have wondered why she ever took the job in the first place. It wasn't like she needed the money. Mrs. Bukes? Did my dad maybe ask you to come in and help out with Marie? Marie was the woman who'd replaced her, a sturdy, not terribly bright girl in her early 20s, with a big laugh and a heart-shaped can, who provided imagery for my nightly sausage-pounding ceremonies. I couldn't imagine why my father might think Marie would need a hand. We weren't, as far as I knew, anticipating company. I'm not sure we ever even had company. Her smile faltered briefly. She shot one of those anxious looks back over her shoulder, down the road. When she returned her gaze to me, there was only the faintest trace of good humor on her face, and her eyes were frightened.
I don't know, Bucko. You tell me. Was I supposed to clean out the tub? I know I didn't get to it last week, and it's pretty dingy.
Shelley Bukes pawed through her cloth tote, muttering to herself. When she looked up, her lips were squeezed together in an expression of frustration.
Piss on it. I walked out of the house and forgot the fucking Ajax.
I twitched, could not have been more startled if she'd pulled open that trench coat and revealed she was naked. Shelley Bukes wasn't anyone's idea of an uptight old lady. I had a memory of her cleaning our house in a John Belushi t-shirt, but I had never heard her use the word fuck. Even piss on it was quite a bit saltier than her usual conversational fare. Shelley didn't notice my surprise, just went on to say,
Tell your dad I'll take care of the tub tomorrow. I don't need more than 10 minutes to make it shine like no one ever put their ass in it.
Her cloth shoulder bag drooped open. I looked into it and saw a battered, grimy lawn gnome, several empty soda cans, and a single raggedy old sneaker. I'd better go home, she said suddenly, almost robotically. The Afrikaner will be wondering where I got to. The Afrikaner was her husband, Lawrence Bukes, who had emigrated from Cape Town before I was born. At 70, Larry Bukes was one of the most powerfully built men I knew, a former weightlifter with the sculpted arms and vein-threaded neck of a circus strongman. Being huge was his primary professional responsibility. He had made his money on a series of gyms he'd opened in the 70s, just as the oiled, mind-boggling mass of Arnold Schwarzenegger was muscling its way into the public consciousness. Larry and Arnie had once both appeared in the same calendar. Larry was February and flexed in the snow, wearing nothing but a tight black hammock for his nuts. Arnie was June and stood glistening on the beach, a girl in a bikini perched on each gargantuan arm. Shelley darted a last look over her shoulder and then began to shuffle off, moving in a direction that would take her even farther from her house. The moment she looked away from me, she forgot me. I could see it in the way all expression dropped from her face. Her lips began to move as she whispered quiet questions to herself.
Shelley, hey, I was gonna ask Mr. Bukes if, about...
I struggled to think of something Larry Bukes and I might have to discuss.
If he ever thought of hiring anyone to mow the lawn. He's got better things to do, right? Mind if I walk to your house with you?
I reached for her elbow and caught her before she could drift out of reach. She jerked at the sight of me, as if I had craftily snuck up on her, then gave me that brave, challenging smile.
I've told that old man we need to hire someone to cut the...
Her eyes dimmed. She couldn't remember what needed cutting. At last she gave her head a little shake and went on.
The thing for I don't know how long. Come on back with me. And you know what?
She clapped a hand over mine.
I think I've got some of those cookies you like.
She winked, and for an instant I was sure she knew me, and, more than that, knew herself. Shelley Bukes flickered into crisp focus, then went fuzzy again. I could see awareness slip away from her, a light on a dimmer switch being turned down to a dull glow. So I walked her home. I felt bad about her bare feet on the hot road. It was muggy and the mosquitoes were out. After a while, I noticed a red flush across her face and a dew of sweat on her old lady whiskers, and I thought maybe she should take the trench coat off. Although I admit that by then the notion had crossed my mind that maybe she really was naked under there. Given her disorientation, I didn't think it could be ruled out. I fought down my unease and asked if I could carry her coat. She gave her head a quick shake. I don't want to be recognized. This was such a wonderfully daffy thing to say that for a moment I forgot the situation and responded as if Shelley were still herself, a sensible person who loved Jeopardy and cleaned ovens with an almost brutal determination. By who? I asked. She leaned toward me and in a voice that was practically a hiss said, "The Polaroid man. That slick fucking weasel in his convertible. He's been taking pictures when the Afrikaner isn't around. I don't know how much he's taken away with his camera, but he can't have any more." She gripped my wrist. Her body was still stout and big-bosomed, but her hand was as bony and claw-like as a fairy tale crone's. "Don't let him take a picture of you. Don't let him start taking things away." "I'll keep an eye out. Hey, really, Mrs. Bukes, you look like you're melting in that coat. Let me have it, and we'll watch out for him together. You can jump into it again if you see him coming." She leaned her head back and narrowed her eyes, inspecting me the way she might have studied the small print at the bottom of a dubious contract. Finally, she sniffed and shrugged out of the big coat and handed it to me. She was not naked underneath, but wore a pair of black gym shorts and a t-shirt that was on inside out and backward, the tag flopping under her chin. Her legs were knotty and shockingly white, her calves crawling with varicose veins. I folded her coat, sweaty and wrinkled, over one arm, took her hand, and went on. The roads in Golden Orchards, our little housing development north of Cupertino, were laid out like overlapping coils of rope, not a straight line in the whole thing. At first glance, the houses appeared to be a scattershot mix of styles, a Spanish stucco here, a brick colonial there. Spend enough time knocking around the neighborhood, though, and you came to recognize they were all the same house, more or less. Same interior layout, same number of bathrooms, same style windows, dressed up in different costumes. The Bukes house was mock Victorian, but with some kind of beach theme going on. Seashells embedded in the concrete path leading to the steps. A bleached starfish hung from the front door. Maybe Mr. Bukes's gyms were called Neptune Fitness, Atlantis Athletics. Was it maybe a goof on the Nautilus machines that were used in the facilities? I don't remember anymore. A lot of that day, August 15th, 1988, is still sharp in my memory. But I'm not sure I was too clear on that particular detail even then. I led her to the door and knocked, then rang the bell. I could have just let her in. It was her house, after all. But I didn't think that suited the situation. I thought I ought to tell Larry Bukes where she had wandered and find some hopefully not too embarrassing way to let him know how confused she'd been. Shelley gave no sign she recognized her own house. She stood at the bottom of the steps looking placidly around, waiting patiently. A few moments earlier, she'd seemed sly and even slightly threatening. Now she looked like a bored granny going door to door with her Boy Scout grandson, keeping him company while he sold magazine subscriptions. Bumblebees burrowed into nodding white flowers. For the first time, it struck me that maybe Larry Bukes really did need to hire someone to cut his grass. The yard was unkempt and weedy, dandelions spotting the lawn. The house itself needed a power wash, had spots of mold high under the eaves. It had been a while since I'd walked by the place, and who knew when I had last really looked at it, not just let my gaze slide over it. Larry Bukes had always maintained his property with the diligence and energy of a Prussian field marshal. He was out there twice a week in a muscle shirt, pushing a powerless hand mower, his delts tanned and rippling, his cleft chin lifted dramatically. He had great fucking posture. Other lawns were green and tidy. His was meticulous. Of course, I was only 13 when all this happened, and I understand now what I didn't at the time. It was all getting away from Lawrence Bukes. His ability to manage to keep up with even the mild demands of suburban living was being overwhelmed, a little at a time, as he wore down under the strain of looking after a woman who could no longer look after herself. I suppose it was only his inherent sense of optimism and conditioning, his sense of personal fitness, if you will, that allowed him to go on, kidding himself that he could handle it all. I was beginning to think I might have to walk Shelley back to my house and wait with her there when Mr. Bukes's 10-year-old burgundy town car swerved into the driveway. He was driving it like an outlaw on the run from Starsky and Hutch and bumped one tire up over the curb as he swung in. He got out in a sweat and almost stumbled and fell coming into the yard.
"Oh, Jesus! There you are! I've been looking all over to hell and gone! You almost give me a heart attack!"
Larry's accent just naturally made you think of apartheid, torture, and dictators sitting on gilt thrones in marble palaces with salamanders scampering along the walls. Which was too bad. He had made his money hauling around iron, not blood diamonds. He had his flaws. He'd voted for Reagan. He believed that Carl Weathers was a great thespian. And he grew emotional listening to ABBA. But he revered and adored his wife. And balanced against that, his personal blemishes were no matter at all. He went on.
"What did you do? I go next door to ask Mr. Bannerman if he off detergent. I come beg, you are gone like a gal in a David Copperfield trick."
He grabbed her in his arms. Seemed like he might be about to give her a hard shake, then hugged her instead. He looked over her shoulder at me, his eyes glittering with tears. "It's okay, Mr. Bukes," I said. "She's fine. She was just kind of lost." "I wasn't lost," she said, and she showed him a small, knowing smile.
"I was hiding from the Polaroid man."
He shook his head.
"Hush. Hush yourself, woman. Let's get you out of the sun and, oh, Lord, your feet. I should make you take your feet off before you go inside. You will track your filth everywhere."
All this sounds kind of savage and cruel, but his eyes were wet, and he spoke with a gruff, wounded affection, talking to her the way you might speak to a beloved old cat that had gotten itself into a fight and come home missing an ear. He marched her past me, up the brick steps and into the house. I was about to go, thought I had already been forgotten, when he turned back to jab a trembling finger at my nose.
"I have something for you," he said. "Do not float off, Michael Figlioni."
And he banged the door shut. 2. From a certain point of view, his choice of words was almost funny. There was really no danger I was going to float off on him. We have not yet touched upon the elephant in the room, which is that, at the age of 13, I was the elephant in any room I stepped into. I was fat. Not big-boned, not sturdy, certainly not merely husky. When I walked across the kitchen, glasses rattled in the cupboard. When I stood among the other kids of my 8th grade class, I looked like a buffalo wandering among the prairie dogs. In this modern age of social media and sensitivity to bullying, if you call someone a fat ass, you'll likely find yourself on the receiving end of some abuse yourself for body shaming. But in 1988, Twitter was a verb used only to describe what sparrows and gossiping biddies did. I was fat, and I was lonely. In those days, if you were the former, the latter was a given. I had plenty of time for walking old ladies home. I wasn't neglecting my buddies. I didn't have any. None who were my age, anyway. My father sometimes drove me to the Bay to attend monthly meetings of a club called SF GRU, the San Francisco Gathering of Robotics Users and Enthusiasts. But most of the others at those get-togethers were much older than I. Older and already stereotypes. I don't even need to describe them because you can already see them in your mind's eye. The bad complexions, the thick-lensed glasses, the unzipped flies. When I dropped in on this crew, I wasn't just learning about circuit boards. I believed I was looking at my future, depressing late-night arguments about Star Trek, and a life of celibacy. It didn't help, of course, that my last name was Figlioni, which, when translated into 1980s elementary school English, became Fats Baloney, or Fag Alone, or just plain old Fags, monikers that stuck to me like gum on my sneaker until I was in my 20s. Even my beloved fifth-grade science teacher, Mr. Kent, once accidentally called me Fag Alone to uproarious laughter. He at least had the decency to blush and look sick and apologize. My existence could have been much worse. I was clean and I was neat, and by never studying French, I was able to avoid honor roll, that list of smug know-it-alls and teacher's pets who were just begging for a wedgie. I never faced anything worse than the occasional low-grade humiliation, and when I was teased, I always smiled indulgently, as if I were getting ragged by a dear friend. Shelley Bukes couldn't remember what had happened yesterday. As a rule, I never wanted to. The door was flung open again and Larry Bukes was back. I turned to see him wiping one enormous calloused hand across his wet cheek. I was embarrassed and looked away out toward the street. I had no experience with weeping adults. My father was not a particularly emotional man, and I doubt that my mother was much for tears, although I couldn't say for sure. I only ever saw her 2 or 3 months out of every year. Larry Bukes had come from Africa, whereas my mother had gone there for an anthropological study and, in a sense, never really came back. Even when she was home, a part of her remained 6,000 miles away, beyond reach. At the time, I was not angry about this. For children, anger usually requires proximity. That changes.
I drove all around this neighborhood looking for her. A goddamn simple old thing. This is the third time. I thought this time she will walk into traffic. A silly goddamn... Thank you for bringing her back to me. Bless you, Michael Figlioni. God bless your heart.
He pulled a pocket inside out and money sprayed everywhere, crumpled bills and loose silver scattering across the walk and the grass. I realized with something like alarm that he meant to tip me.
Oh, jeez, Mr. Bukes, it's okay, you don't have to. I'm glad to help. I'd feel stupid taking...
He narrowed one eye and glared at me with the other.
This is more than a reward. This is a down payment.
He bent and scooped up a $10 bill and held it out to me.
Go on. Take this.
When I didn't, he stuck it in the breast pocket of my Hawaiian shirt.
Michael, if I have to go somewhere, can I call on you to look after her? I am home all day. All I do is look after this crazy woman. But sometimes I have to buy groceries or run to one of the gyms to put out a fire. There is always a fire to put out. Every musclehead who works for me can lift 400 pounds, but not one of them could count past 10. That is where they run out of fingers.
He patted the money in my shirt and took his wife's coat away from me. It had still been hanging over my forearm, like a waiter's towel, forgotten.
So, we off a deal?
Sure, Mr. Bukes. She used to babysit me. I guess I can...
Yes, babysit her. She has entered her second childhood. God help her and me, too. She needs someone to make sure she doesn't go wandering, looking for him.
The Polaroid man.
She told you about him?
I nodded. He shook his head, smoothed a hand back over his thinning, brill-creamed hair.
I worry someday she will see someone walking by and decide it is him and stick a kitchen knife into him. Oh, God. What will I do then?
This wasn't such a smart thing to say to the kid you were trying to hire to look after your old, mentally disintegrating wife. It was impossible not to consider the possibility that she might decide I was the Polaroid man and stick a carving knife into me. But he was distracted and distressed and running his mouth without thought. It didn't matter. I wasn't scared of Shelley Bukes. I felt she could forget everything about me and everything about herself, and it still wouldn't change her fundamental nature, which was affectionate, efficient, and incapable of any real malice. Larry Bukes met my gaze with bloodshot, miserable eyes.
Michael, you will be a rich man someday. You will probably make a fortune inventing the future. Will you do something for me? for your old friend, Larry Bukes, who spent his last years desperate with worry for his fool of a wife with her oatmeal brains, the woman who gave him more happiness than he ever deserved?
He was crying again. I wanted to hide. Instead, I nodded.
Sure, Mr. Bukes. Sure. Invent a way not to get old, he said. It is a terrible goddamn trick to play on someone. Getting old is no way to stop being young.
3. I walked without a plan, hardly aware I was moving, let alone where I was going. I was hot, I was dazed, and I had $10 crushed into my shirt pocket, money I didn't want. My grimy Run DMC Adidas carried me to the nearest place I could get rid of it. There was a big mobile station across the highway from the entrance to the Golden Orchards, a dozen pumps and a deliciously refrigerated convenience store where you could buy beef jerky, Funyuns, and, if you were old enough, skin magazines. That summer I was drinking my own frozen slush concoction, a 32-ounce cup of ice drenched in vanilla Coca-Cola and topped with a squirt of something called Arctic Blue. Arctic Blue was the color of windshield wiper fluid and tasted a little of cherry and a little of watermelon. I was mad for the stuff, but if I came across it nowadays, I probably wouldn't try it. I think to my 40-year-old palate, it would taste of adolescent sadness. I had my heart set on an Arctic Blue Coca-Cola slush special and just didn't know it until I saw the mobile's revolving red Pegasus atop its 40-foot pole. The parking lot had recently been repaved with fresh tar, black and thick as cake. Heat wobbled off it, causing the whole place to quiver faintly, a hallucinated oasis glimpsed by a man dying of thirst. I didn't notice the white caddy at pump 10, and I didn't see the guy standing next to it until he spoke to me. "Hey," he said, and when I didn't react, I was in a sunstruck daydream. He said it again, less nice. "Hey, Pillsbury." I heard him that time. My radar was attuned to any blip that might represent the threat of a bully, and it pinged at Pillsbury and the man's tone of good-humored contempt. He didn't have a lot of room to go ragging on people about their looks. He was dressed well enough, even if his clothes looked out of place. In duds like his, he belonged at the door to a nightclub in San Francisco, not at a mobile pump in a nowhere California suburb. He wore a silky black short-sleeved shirt with glassy red buttons, long black pants with a blade-sharp crease, black cowboy boots embroidered with red and white thread. But he was feverishly ugly. His chin sunk most of the way back into his long neck, his cheeks corroded with old acne scars. His deeply tanned forearms were covered in black tattoos, what appeared to be lines of cursive script running around them in long, snake-like swirls down to his wrists. He wore a string tie, those were popular in the 80s, secured with a lucite clasp. A yellowing scorpion was curled within. "Yes, sir?" I asked. "You going in? Get yourself a Twinkie or something?" He thunked the pump's nozzle into the gas tank of his big white boat. "Yes, sir," I said, thinking, "Suck my Twinkie, asshole." He reached into his front pocket and wiggled out a wad of yellowing dirty bills. He peeled off a 20. "Tell you what, you take this inside, tell him to switch on pump 10, and, hey, Land O'Lakes, I'm talking to you, listen up." My attention had drifted away for a moment, my gaze caught by the object sitting on the trunk of his caddy. A Polaroid instant camera. You probably know what a Polaroid looks like, even if you're too young to have ever used one or seen one used. The original Polaroid instant is so recognizable and represents such an enormous technological leap forward that it became an icon of its era. It belongs to the 80s, like Pac-Man and Reagan. These days, everyone has a camera in his pocket. The idea of snapping a picture and being able to examine it immediately strikes absolutely no one as spectacular. But in the summer of 1988, the Polaroid was one of just a few devices that would allow you to shoot a picture and have it develop more or less instantly. The camera popped out a thick white square with a gray rectangle of film in the center, and after a couple minutes, faster if you shook the square back and forth to activate the developing agent within its chemical envelope, an image would swim up out of the murk and solidify into a photograph. That was cutting edge back then. When I saw the camera, I knew it was him. The guy, the Polaroid man, that Mrs. Bukes was hiding from. The slick-looking weasel in his white Cadillac convertible with its red top and red seats. He color-coded like a motherfucker. I knew that whatever Mrs. Bukes believed about this guy had no basis in fact, of course, that it was a misfire from an engine already choked up and giving out. Yet something she'd said stuck with me. Don't let him take a picture of you. When I put it all together, when I realized the Polaroid man was not a senile fantasy but a real dude standing right in front of me, my back and arms prickled with chill. Go ahead, mister. I'm listening. Here, he said. Take this 20 in and get him to light up this pump. My caddy is thirsty, but I'll tell you what, kiddo. If there's any change, it's all yours. Buy yourself a diet book. I didn't even blush. It was a nasty swipe, but in my distracted state, it barely grazed my consciousness. On second glance, I saw that it wasn't a Polaroid. Not exactly. I knew the devices pretty well. I had taken one apart once and recognized that this was subtly different. It was, for starters, black with a red face, so it matched the car and the clothes. But also, it was just different, sleeker. It sat on the trunk, within hand's reach of Mr. Slick, and it was turned slightly away from me, so I couldn't see the brand name. A Konica? I wondered. What struck me most right away was that a Polaroid had a hinged drawer you opened at the front to slide in a package of instant film. I couldn't see how this one loaded. The device seemed to be made of one smooth piece. He saw me eyeing the camera and did a curious thing. He put a protective hand on it. An old lady, gripping her purse a little tighter as she walks past some street toughs. He extended the dingy-looking 20 with his other hand. I came around the rear bumper and reached for the money. My gaze shifted to the writing scrolled up his forearm. I didn't recognize the alphabet, but it looked similar to Hebrew. "Cool ink," I said. "What language is that?" "Phoenician." "What's it say?" "It says don't fuck with me, more or less." I tucked the money into my shirt pocket and began to shuffle away from him, moving in reverse. I was too scared of him to turn my back on him. I wasn't looking where I was going and veered off course, bumped into the rear fender, and almost fell down. I put a hand on the trunk to steady myself and glanced around, and that was how I saw the photo albums. There were maybe a dozen of them stacked along the back seat. One of them was open, and I could see Polaroids slid into clear plastic sleeves, four on each sheet. The photos themselves were nothing special. An overlit shot of an old man blowing out the candles on a birthday cake, a rain-bedraggled corgi staring into the camera with tragic, hungry eyes, a muscle-bound dude in a hilariously orange tank top, sitting on the hood of a Trans Am straight out of Knight Rider. That last one caught my gaze. I felt I vaguely knew the young man in the tank top. I wondered if I'd seen him on TV, if he was a wrestler, had climbed into the ring with the Hulkster to go a few rounds. "You got a lot of pictures," I said. "It's what I do. I'm a scout." "Scout? For the movies. I see an interesting place, I shoot a picture of it. I see an interesting face, I shoot a picture of that." He lifted one corner of his mouth to show a snaggly tooth. "Why? You want to be a movies kid? You want me to take your picture? Hey, you never can tell. Maybe some casting agent will like your face. Next thing you know, Hollywood, baby." He was fingering the camera in a way I didn't like, with a kind of twitchy eagerness. Even in the theoretically more innocent time of the late 1980s, I wasn't keen to pose for photographs taken by a guy who looked like he bought his clothes at Pedophiles R Us. And then there was what Shelley had said to me. Don't let him take a picture of you. That warning was a poisonous spider with hairy legs crawling down my spine. "I don't think so," I said. "It might be too hard to fit all of me in one shot." I gestured with both hands at my paunch, straining against my shirt. His eyes bulged in his corroded face for an instant, and then he laughed, a raw, horsey sound that was part disbelief, part real hilarity. He pointed a finger at me, thumb cocked like the hammer of a gun. "You're okay, kid. I like you. Just don't get lost on the way to the cash register." I walked away from him on unsteady legs, and not just because I was escaping a creep with an ugly mouth and an uglier face. I was a rational child. I read Isaac Asimov, hero-worshipped Carl Sagan, and felt a certain spiritual affinity with Andy Griffith's Matlock. I knew that Shelley Bukes' ideas about the Polaroid man, only I was already thinking of him as the Phoenician, were the addled fantasies of a mind sliding apart. Her warnings shouldn't have rated a second thought, but they did. They had, in the last few moments, assumed an almost oracular power and worried me as much as it would have worried me to learn I had seat 13 on flight 1313 on Friday the 13th. And never mind that 13 is a pretty cool number, not just a prime or a Fibonacci, but also an emirp, which means it stays prime if you reverse the digits and make it 31. I got inside the mini mart, dug the money out of my shirt pocket, and dropped it on the counter. "Put it on pump 10 for the nice guy in the caddy," I said to Mrs. Matsuzaka, who stood behind the register alongside her kid, Yoshi. Only no one ever called him Yoshi except her. He went by Matt, 1T. Matt had a shaved head and long, ropey arms, and he affected a laconic surfer dude ease. He was 5 years older than me and heading off to Berkeley at the end of the summer. He was looking to put his parents out of business by inventing a car that didn't need gas. "Hey, fags," he said, and tossed me a nod, which cheered me up some. Yeah, all right, he called me fags, but I didn't take it personally. To most kids, that was just my name. That may sound savagely homophobic now, and it was. But in 1988, the era of AIDS and Eddie Murphy, calling someone a fag or a queer was considered high wit. By the standards of the day, Matt was a model of sensitivity. He read Popular Mechanics faithfully, cover to cover, and sometimes when I wandered into the mobile mini-mart, he'd give me one of his back issues, because he'd seen something in there he thought I'd dig, a prototype jetpack or a personal one-man submarine. I don't want to misrepresent him. We weren't friends. He was 17 and cool. I was 13 and desperately uncool. A friendship between us was about as likely as my scoring a date with Tawny Katane. But I believe he felt a certain pitying affection for me and had a nebulous urge to look after me, maybe because we were both circuit heads at heart. I was grateful for any kindness from other kids in those days. I went to grab an extra large cup of my frozen Arctic Blue Coca-Cola slush special. I needed it more than ever. My stomach was restless and gurgling, and I wanted something with a little fizz to settle it. I had hardly finished adding the last neon-bright splash of blue when the Phoenician pushed in the door with his forearm, giving it a hard shove like he had something personal against it. The open door blocked his view of the soda dispenser, which is the only reason he didn't see me as he cast his glare around the room. He didn't miss a step, but stalked up to Mrs. Matsuzaka. "What's the man got to do to get a tank of fucking gas around this joint? Why'd you shut off the pump?" Mrs. Matsuzaka was barely 5 feet tall and delicately built, and she had mastered the blank, uncomprehending expression common to first-generation immigrants who understand the language just fine, but occasionally find it easier to feign bafflement. She lifted her shoulders in a weak shrug and let Matt do the talking for her. "You pay $10, brah. $10 of gas is what you get," Matt said from his position on a stool behind the counter, under the racks of cigarettes. "Either of you two know how to count in English?" said the Phoenician. "I sent the kid in with a fucking 20. It was like I drank my entire Arctic Blue Coca-Cola slush special in one swallow. My blood surged with cold shock. I clapped a hand in my shirt pocket with a thrill of horror. Right away, I knew what I'd done. I reached into my pocket, felt money there, and tossed it on the counter without looking at it. But I'd handed over the 10 that Larry Bukes had forced on me earlier, not the 20 the Phoenician had given me in the parking lot. The only thing I could think to do was abase myself as quickly and fully as possible. I was ready to cry, and the Phoenician hadn't even screamed at me yet. I reeled into the front of the store, hip-checking a wire shelf of potato chips. Bags of Lay's scattered everywhere. I clawed the 20 out of my shirt pocket.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I'm sorry. Oh, man. Oh, I screwed that up. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't even look at the money when I threw it on the counter, mister, and I must have put down my 10 instead of your 20. I swear I didn't. When I said you could keep the change and buy yourself some weight loss pills, I didn't mean you could fuck me out of a sawbuck. He lifted one hand as if he had a mind to catch me upside the head. He'd come in with his camera. It was clutched in his other hand, and even as rattled as I was, I thought it was odd he wouldn't have just left it in the car. No, really, I never, I swear to God! I was babbling, my eyes tingling dangerously, threatening to spill tears. In my haste, I set my enormous 32-ounce blue slurry on the edge of the counter, and the moment I let go of it, a bad situation turned so, so much worse. The cup toppled and dropped, hit the floor, and exploded in a vibrant gout of blue ice. Glowing blue chips sprayed the Phoenician's perfectly pressed black pants, splashed his crotch, and threw sapphire droplets on his camera. The fuck? He screamed, dancing back on the toes of his cowboy boots. Are you fucking retarded, you enormous pile of turd? Hey, shouted Matt's mom, pointing at the Phoenician. Hey, no fight in store. I call cop. The Phoenician looked down at his blue spattered clothes and back up at me. His face darkened. He put the Polaroid that wasn't on the counter and took a step toward me. I don't know what he meant to do, but he was shaken up, and his left foot skidded in the spreading pile of Arctic blue Coke slush. Those boots had high Cuban heels, and they looked good, but they must have been as tricky as walking around in 6-inch stilettos. He came very close to slamming down on one knee. I'll clean it up, I cried out. Oh, man, I'm so sorry. I'll clean it all up. And, oh, Jesus, believe me, I've never tried to cheat anyone out of anything. I'm really honest. If I fart, I always cop right to it, even when I'm on the school bus. I swear to God, swear. Yeah, bro, chill, Matt said, rising from his stool. He was sinewy and tall, and with his dark eyes and shaved head, he didn't need to make a threat to look like one. Take it easy. Fags is okay. I guarantee he wasn't trying to screw you. And you can stay the fuck out of it, the Phoenician said to him. Or try paying attention before you choose sides. Kid rips me for $10, throws his drink on me, and then I just about break my ass in this puddle of shit. Don't put the boots on if you can't walk in them, pard, Matt said without looking at him. You might get hurt one of these days. Matt handed a big roll of paper towels across the counter, and as I took them, he gave me a wink so quick, so subtle, I almost missed it. I felt almost shaky with gratitude. That was how relieved I was to have Matt on my side. I tore off a fistful of paper towels and immediately dropped to my knees in the slush to begin swiping at the Phoenician's trousers. You could be forgiven if you thought I was getting ready to give him a blowjob by way of apology. Aw, man, I've always been so clumsy. Always. I can't even roller skate. He danced away, almost slipping again, then leaned in and snatched the clod of sodden paper towels away from me. Hey! Hey, no touch. You get down there on your knees like someone who's had way too much practice. Keep your hands off my dick, thank you. I got it. He gave me a look that said I had crossed the line from someone who needed an ass stomping to someone he didn't want anywhere near him. He swiped at his pants and shirt, whispering bitterly to himself. I still had the paper towel roll, though, and I splashed through slush and grabbed his camera to clean it off. By then, I was so nervous and wretched, I was moving in spastic bursts, and when I picked up the camera, my hand pressed the big red button to take a shot. The lens was pointing across the counter into Matt's face when the Polaroid went off with a snap of white light and a high-pitched mechanical whine. The photo didn't just pop out. The camera launched it from the slot, firing the square of plastic across the counter and over the far side. Matt snapped his head back, blinking rapidly, blinded by the flash, perhaps. I was a little blind myself. Weird, coppery glowworms crawled before my eyes. I shook my head, stared stupidly down at the camera in my right hand. The brand was Solarid, a company I'd never heard of and, as far as I know, never existed, not in this country or any other. Put that down, the Phoenician said in a new tone of voice.
I thought I'd heard him at his scariest when he was yelling at me. But this was different and much worse. This was the sound of the cylinder turning in a revolver, the click of the hammer cocking back. "I was just trying to," I began, my tongue thick in my mouth. "You're trying to get yourself hurt, and you're about to succeed." He held out a hand, and I put the Solarid in it. If I dropped the camera, if it slipped out of my sweaty, shaking hand, I believe he would have killed me, put his hand on my throat, and squeezed. I believed that then, and I believe it now. His gray eyes regarded me with a cold, curdled fury, and his pocked face was as inexpressive as a rubber mask. He tugged the camera away from me, and the moment passed. He swung his gaze to the young man, an elderly woman behind the counter. "The picture. Give me the picture," he said. Matt still seemed dazed from the camera's flash. He looked at me. He looked at his mother. He seemed to have lost the thread of the entire conversation. The Phoenician ignored him and focused his attention upon Mrs. Matsuzaka. He held out a hand. "That's my photo, and I want it. My camera, my film, my photo." Her gaze swept the floor around her, and then she looked up and shrugged again. "It popped out and fell on your side of the counter," the Phoenician said, speaking loudly and slowly, the way people do when they're hideously angry with a foreigner, as if translation were aided by volume. "We all saw it. Look for it. Look around your feet." Matt rubbed the balls of his palms into his eyes, dropped them, and yawned. "What's up?" As if he had just shoved back the sheets and walked out of his bedroom into the middle of an argument. His mother said something to him in Japanese, her voice rapid and distressed. He stared at her in a kind of foggy daze, then lifted his chin and looked at the Phoenician. "What's the problem, brah?" "The picture. The photograph the fat kid took of you. I want it." "What's the big deal? If I find it, you want me to autograph it for you?" The Phoenician was done talking. He stalked around to the waist-high door that would let him in behind the counter and the cash register. Matt's mom had returned to scanning the floor in a forlorn sort of way, but now her head twitched up, and she put her hand on the inside of the swinging door before he could come through. Her expression became severely disapproving. "No! Customer stay other side! No! No!" "I want that fucking photograph," the Phoenician said. "Yo, brah!" If Matt had been in a daze, he shook it off then. He stepped between his mother and the Phoenician, and suddenly Matt seemed very large. "You heard her. Back off. Company policy. No one on this side of the counter who don't work here. You don't like it? Buy a postcard and send your complaint to mobile. They're dying to hear from you." "Can we move this along? I have a baby in the car," said the woman who was standing behind me with an armful of cat food cans. "What, did you think it was just the four of us in the mobile mart all this time?" While I threw my Arctic Blue special at the Phoenician, and he cursed and sulked and threatened, people were coming in, grabbing drinks and chips and plastic-wrapped hoagies, and forming into a line behind me. By now, the queue stretched halfway to the back of the store. Matt moved behind the register. "Next customer." The mom with the armful of cans stepped carefully around that sci-fi colored puddle of vividly glittering blue, and Matt began to ring up her purchases. The Phoenician stared in disbelief. Matt's curt dismissal was an outrage on a par with my flinging frosty blue down his pants. "You know what? Fuck this. Fuck this store and fuck this fat waste and fuck you, Slant. I got enough gas to get out of this shithole, and that's more than enough. I wouldn't want to blow one penny more than absolutely necessary in this toilet." "That's $189," Matt said to the woman with the cat food. "No extra charge for the afternoon's entertainment." The Phoenician reached the door, but paused, half in, half out, to glare back at me. "I won't forget you, kid. Look both ways before you cross the street. Know what I mean?" I was too choked up with fright to squeak any kind of reply. He banged out the door. A moment later, his caddy blasted away from the pumps and onto the two-lane highway with a shrill whine of tires.
I used the rest of the paper towels to mop the slush off the floor. It was a relief to get down on my knees below eye level where I could have a semi-private cry.
I was 13, man.
Customers stepped around me, paid for things, and left, considerately pretending they couldn't hear my sniffling and choked gasps. When I had the mess swabbed up, the floor was tacky but dry. I carried a great mass of sopping paper rags over to the counter. Mrs. Matsuzaka stood to one side of her son, her eyes far away and her mouth crimped in a frown. But when she saw me with my load of wet towels, she came out of her thoughts and reached for the big industrial waste basket behind the counter. She wheeled it over toward me, and that's when I saw it. The snapshot was face down on the floor, in the corner, and had slid under the bin and out of sight. Mrs. Matsuzaka saw it, too, and went back for it while I dumped my soggy paper towels into the trash can. She stared down at the photo with incomprehension. She looked over at me, then held it out so I could have a look. It should have been a close-up of Matt. The lens had been right in his face. Instead, it was a photograph of me. Only, it wasn't a shot of me from a few minutes ago. It was from a few weeks earlier. In the picture, I sat in a molded plastic chair by the soda machine, reading Popular Mechanics and sipping on a giant plastic cup full of soda. In the Polaroid? I was wearing a white Huey Lewis t-shirt and a pair of knee-length denim shorts. Today, I had on khakis and a Hawaiian shirt with pockets. The photographer had to have been standing behind the counter. It didn't make any sense. And I stared at it in complete bafflement, trying to figure out where it had come from. It couldn't be the picture I'd just accidentally shot, but I also didn't see how it could be a snap from a few weeks back. I had no memory of Matt or his mom taking my picture while I read one of Matt's magazines. I couldn't imagine why they'd want to do such a thing, and I had never seen either one of them with a Polaroid camera. I swallowed and said, "Can I have that?" Mrs. Matsuzaka took one last bewildered look at the photograph, then pursed her lips and put it on the counter. She slid it across to me, and when she took her hand back, she rubbed the tips of her fingers together, as if it had left a disagreeable coating on her skin. I studied it for a moment longer, with a clenched, ill feeling behind my breastbone, a cramped sensation of anxiety that wasn't entirely a product of the Phoenician's rage and threats. I tucked the picture into my shirt pocket and eased over to the cash register. I put the 20 on the counter, thinking, with a shudder, that's his money. And what's he going to do when he realizes you never gave it back? Better look both ways when you cross the street. Better look both fucking ways, fags. See, I even insulted myself. Sorry about the mess, I said. That's for the 32-ounce soda. Whatever, brah, I ain't gonna charge you for that. Just a little spilled sugar water. Matt pushed my money back toward me. Okay, well, I owe you one for not letting him kick my ass. You saved my life there, Matt. Sincerely. Sure, sure, he said, although he had narrowed his eyes and was giving me a puzzled smile, as if he weren't quite sure what I was talking about. He considered me for a moment longer, then gave his head a little shake. Hey, ask you something? Sure. What, Matt? You talk like we know each other. Have we met before? 4. I walked out of there with my nerves jangling and a sick buzz in my head. By the time I left, I was reasonably certain that Matt didn't have any goddamn clue who I was and had no memory of ever seeing me before. Never mind that I walked into that mobile every day and had been reading his used copies of Popular Mechanics for more than a year. He simply didn't know me anymore, an idea that rattled me badly. I told myself I didn't understand, that it was crazy, that it didn't make sense. But this wasn't entirely the truth. I already had a notion about Matt's sudden forgetfulness nibbling at the edge of my consciousness. I was aware of it in the way you might be aware of a rat scuttling inside the walls. You can hear the furtive scrabble of its claws, the thump of its torso against the drywall. You know it's there, you just haven't set your eyes on it. My notion about Matt and the Solarid was so horror movie terrible, so Steven Spielberg impossible, that I couldn't bear to consider it straight on. Not yet. I returned home in a state of persistent, low-grade panic. It took me 10 minutes to cross the distance between the mobile and my house on Plum Street. In my mind, I died 7 times on the way. Twice, I heard the Phoenician's tires squealing on the blacktop and turned to see the shiny chrome grille in the half-second before the Caddy slammed into me. Once, the Phoenician slid to a stop behind me, got out with a tire iron, chased me into the woods, and beat me to death in the brush. He ran me down as I tried to scamper across the Thatcher family's front yard, and he drowned me in their purple inflatable wading pool. The last thing I saw was a headless G.I. Joe sunk to the bottom. The Phoenician drove past, nice and slow, and hung his left arm out the window with a gun in it, put 2 bullets in me, one in my neck, one in my cheek. He drove past, nice and slow, and lopped my head off with a rusty machete. Whack! He drove past, nice and slow, and said, "Hey, kid, how's it going?" And my weak heart stopped in my fat chest, and I fell dead of a massive cardiac arrest at age 13. So young, so full of promise. The snapshot was in my shirt pocket. I felt it there as if it were a square of warm radioactive material, something that could give me cancer. It could not have made me more uneasy if it were kiddie porn. Possessing it felt criminal. It felt like evidence. Although of what crime, I could not have told you. I cut across the grass and let myself into the house. I heard a mechanical whirring and followed the sound into the kitchen. My father was out of bed and using the electric beater on a bowl of orange-tinted whipped cream. Something was baking in the oven, and the air was redolent of the warm scent of gravy, an odor quite like a freshly opened can of Alpo. "I smell dinner. What's in the oven?" "Battle of Stalingrad," he said. "What's the orange stuff you're whipping up?" "Topping for the Panama Thrill." I opened the fridge looking for Kool-Aid, and found the Panama Thrill, a mountainous sculpture of jello, cherries suspended within its quaking mass. My father only knew how to make a few things. Jello, pasta dishes with ground beef in them, chicken topped with sauces made out of Campbell's canned soups. His real gift in the kitchen was for naming the meals. It was Battle of Stalingrad one night, Chainsaw Massacre the next. That was a weird mess of white beans and meat in a bloody red sauce. Fidel's cigar for lunch, a brown tortilla stuffed with shredded pork and pieces of pineapple, and farmer pizza for breakfast, an open-faced omelet piled with cheese and random chopped leftovers. He wasn't a fatso like me, but thanks to our diet, he wasn't anyone's idea of trim. If we passed each other in the hall, we both had to turn sideways. I poured the Kool-Aid, drank off the entire glass in 4 swallows. Not good enough, I poured another. "It's almost ready," he said. I made a humming sound of acceptance. Battle of Stalingrad was mashed potatoes topped with shaved steak and a bottled gravy and mushroom sauce. Eating it was roughly like consuming a bucket of liquid cement. I felt boiled after my hike to the mobile and back, and the dog food smell of dinner was making me ill. "You're not enthusiastic?" he asked. "No, I'm eager." "Sorry it's not Mom's apple pie, but I gotta tell you, even if she was here, I don't think she makes pie." "Do I look like a kid who needs pie?" He glanced at me sidelong and said, "You look like a kid who maybe needs a shot of Pepto-Bismol. You okay?" "I'm just going to sit in the dark and cool off," I said. "I haven't been this hot since I was fighting off the Kong outside Khe San." "Let's not talk about that. If I start thinking about the boys we left behind, I'll begin crying in the whipped cream." I went out, whistling "Goodnight, Saigon." My dad and I had an ongoing riff about the time we'd spent fighting the North Vietnamese together, the arms we'd run to the Contras, the helicopter crash we'd barely survived on a mission to save the hostages in Iran. The truth was, neither of us had ever been out of California, except for one trip to Hawaii when we were still a family in the traditional sense. My mother was the one who had adventures in faraway places. My parents were technically still married, But my mother lived with the tribal peoples of the Southwest African coast and was only home for a month here and a month there. When she was stateside, she made me uneasy.